Good morning, happy St. Patrick's Day, and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. We have sunny skies predicted for today, but the last few weeks of late winter weather has been hard, even devastating in some areas of Oregon and Washington. For Oregonians living outside, rough weather is just one of the difficulties. Leah Moriarty reports from the Rogue Valley, where a place called Hope Village is providing a safe and legal option for the homeless and camp dwellers.
To get safe, secure housing available to people immediately.
The idea is to foster a self-governing community where residents manage the project themselves and enforce safe, sober, and responsible behavior. And according to urban planner and author Andrew Heben, it's way cheaper than the standard approach to homelessness.
Also in this edition, when we hear the words bulimia and anorexia, we might think these terms apply mostly to models, or perhaps we think of certain athletes that need to keep their weight in strict check. We'll hear a report in just a few minutes that may surprise you. More than 3,500 service members were diagnosed with eating disorders in the last 10 years. Anorexia and bulimia are showing up in the armed services at what the Department of Defense is calling a surprising rate. But first, we look at important legislation recently signed into law by Oregon Governor Kate Brown. Friday, the governor signed one of the nation's most aggressive pieces of pro-climate legislation, making Oregon the first state to eliminate coal from its energy supply by law. This is to happen in phases through 2030. It also requires utilities to provide half of their customers' power from renewable sources by 2040, doubling the previous standard. Oregon joins five other states with the most stringent requirements in the United States. The governor and her fellow Democrats say it's an important step in Oregon's shift from fossil fuels to clean energy. Among the clean energy industries that will benefit from the law is the wind and solar energy industry, new industries with new ideas, and according to Kristen Graff, executive director of Women of Wind Energy, more women are interested in the field, even though men largely make up the workforce now.
Young women in K through 12 programs interested in science and technology and often interested in it as a way to address larger world problems. So why not connect them to renewable energy and jobs that are creating clean technologies?
According to a survey by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in 2013, about one in five wind energy employees was a woman. Rachel Shimshack is executive director of Renewable Northwest, a Portland-based advocacy group for clean energy. She's noticed a change in the demographics since she began working with wind energy industry nearly four decades ago. According to Shimshack, wind energy has made a special effort to identify opportunities for women. Organizations like Women of Wind Energy is trying to reach out to mentor people to include them in the industry. Some of the jobs, such as wind turbine technician, require extensive training and certifications. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, turbine technician is the fastest growing occupation in the country. Graff's advice for women interested in the field is to find a role model already working in the wind industry.
And then I would say connect to the other women around the industry, especially in the Northwest. We have some really strong Women of Wind Energy chapters.
The American Wind Energy Association reports wind energy makes up more than 12% of Oregon's in-state energy production. Oregon's longest-running political conference is folding its tent on the coast after more than 50 years. Jeff Mapes reports that leaders of the Dorchester Conference will move the event to Salem.
Former Senator Bob Packwood founded Dorchester in Lincoln City in 1965 as a way to stamp his brand of moderate Republicanism on the party. For years, Dorchester attracted prominent Republican speakers, debated provocative issues, and hosted a parody show skewering politicians of both parties. Most importantly, it gave Republican activists a chance to rub shoulders with the party's top elected officials. But as Democrats increasingly dominate state politics, there aren't many Republican stars left. Attendance used to run around 700 in election years. Only about half that number registered to attend this weekend's conference in Seaside. Dorchester President Tom Simpson says leaders will try to revive the conference by moving to Salem next year. He hopes legislators and activists alike will find it easier to attend. In Seaside, Jeff Mapes.
Each year, authorities in Medford and Jackson County stage close to a dozen sweep operations along the Bear Creek Greenway, ousting homeless campers and often confiscating their belongings. Within days, many of the campers are back, usually because they simply have nowhere else to go. Now a proposal that builds on successful projects around the Northwest is gaining momentum in the Rogue Valley. Leah Moriarty reports.
On a flatbed trailer in the parking lot of a church on West Main Street in Medford sits a really, really small house. Aqua green with blue trim, it's got tight double insulated windows, a little front porch with a roof over it, and a door that locks. On the porch, I meet Michael Lacante and his companion.
And who is this?
This is Khaleesi. She's my service dog. She helps me with my PSD to keep me calm.
Lacante opens the door and gives me the grand tour.
Basically, it's just an 8x10, about 80 square feet, three windows all the way around, and then I believe there's one at the top, too, above the loft there.
The interior is unpainted plywood, ceiling, walls, and floor. It's about as basic as shelter gets.
There's no electricity or running water in it, pretty much like how it would be if I was at my tent, basically.
Lacante has been homeless for years, camping in various locations around the Bear Creek Greenway, staying one step ahead of the periodic sweeps. Now he's on the board of a group that hopes to offer homeless people a cleaner, safer alternative to illegal camping. It's called Hope Village. The vision is to put 15 of these stripped-down tiny houses on a piece of land with porta-potties, dumpsters, and a common kitchen area. Heather Everett with the Jackson County Homeless Task Force says this isn't meant to be a long-term solution to homelessness.
This is a place where people can lock up their belongings during the day if they're looking for work, a place where they can lock the doors at night and be safe from harm or people stealing their things. It's a step towards transitional housing or permanent housing.
Bud Everett says,
in the absence of any other alternatives, this is the fastest, cheapest way to get safe, secure housing available to people immediately.
The idea is to foster a self-governing community where residents manage the project themselves and enforce safe, sober, and responsible behavior. This is a model that's proven itself over the past two decades in Seattle, Portland, Eugene, and other Northwest cities. And according to urban planner and author Andrew Heben, it's way cheaper than the standard approach to homelessness.
Police costs, jail costs, healthcare costs, court costs, basically the costs of policing the issue rather than looking for tangible solutions.
Heben says studies have shown the traditional way of dealing with chronically homeless people can cost cities as much as $50,000 per person per year. He says Opportunity Village, a self-managed tiny house community of the homeless in Eugene, is a smarter way. Heben is a co-founder of that project. He says his experience there, as well as in similar projects around the Northwest, has shown that homeless people will rise to the challenge.
Just like neighbors in any community, people want to live in a community of some degree of safety and sanitation. And so when residents are actually given the opportunity to uphold that, what I've seen is that they pursue it.
Now, the Hope Village project in the Rogue Valley is trying to raise the money to buy a parcel of land in Medford. Members are working with local planning officials to make sure the property meets all the necessary codes. Michael Lacante says he hopes to qualify for one of the slots in Hope Village. Having a roof over his head, he says, would mean security and stability in his life.
The stability part is the major for me. I mean, I haven't had it in a couple of years, and I've almost forgotten what it's like.
Hope Village is sponsoring overnight stays in the model tiny house this month to raise awareness of the project and to raise funds to buy the land and build more tiny houses. Organizers hope to break ground this fall. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
You're listening to The Bridge. Our next report comes from KUOW's military affairs reporter, Patricia Murphy. In recent years, military doctors have become more aware of eating disorders among service members. A Department of Defense report concluded that conditions like anorexia and bulimia occur in the military with surprising frequency.
At 23, Marine Lieutenant Teresa Larson was in Fallujah, Iraq, with a platoon of 54 Marines, most of them men. It was 2005. She was escorting female insurgents and leading convoys. Larson was also living with bulimia, binging on whatever was around.
So you have buffets when you're in on the base, but then like when you're off base and doing convoys, there's MREs. So whatever was available, you just eat too much of it. Whatever could be consumed could be thrown up.
Like many people with eating disorders, Larson's evolved over time. As a young Marine, she had dieted down to a super lean physique, but eventually she started to gain weight.
It wasn't a lot, but you can still tell going from super lean to more average size. And when you're in a male-dominated world, they see that. And I didn't want to show weakness. Heading to war, I can't screw up. I had to be perfect.
Larson saw a mental health counselor in Iraq, but he didn't help.
It was like, you're throwing up? Like, why would you do that? I began to realize, like, okay, no one understands this.
Larson knew she was out of control. Her eating disorder had taken over. Larson told her commander she needed to get out of Iraq to get well. She was medically evacuated from Fallujah and started treatment, but was forced to leave the Marines.
So even going from being a very good Marine, taking care of her Marines, all of a sudden she needs to be cared for. Well, too bad. So sad. We need to get you out. We don't know what the hell's wrong with you, and you're a liability now.
A Department of Defense report in 2013 found more than 3,500 service members were diagnosed with eating disorders over the previous 10 years. As a young female Marine, Larson was part of the highest risk group. Many more cases likely were undiagnosed.
The eating disorder really grows in these really dark and secretive places.
Dr. Neeru Bakshi is medical director at Eating Recovery Center in Bellevue, Washington, an intensive outpatient and residential treatment facility. She says service members face a perfect storm of risk factors for eating disorders. There's combat stress, intense pressure to perform, and strict weight limits.
They will actually use their eating disorders to support what they need for those physical requirements. We'll have vets that come to us saying, well, prior to my needing to meet X and Y and Z for my physical requirements test, I was in the gym 6 hours a day. And that's actually a form of their eating disorders.
And part of the problem, Bakshi says, is that it works for them. The thinner, leaner troops tend to get ahead. The heavier ones might get reprimanded. And Bakshi says the armed forces do a poor job providing early intervention for troops who start to develop eating problems.
Within the military, there's this lack of awareness and lack of support that's available for the ongoing treatment. So it's just this setup for the person to be actively engaging in their eating disorder and not getting any kind of help.
That's what Colette Candy is trying to change. She's a psychologist at Madigan Army Medical Center in Tacoma and is one of a handful who treat eating disorders. She says many soldiers she sees have kept their condition secret throughout their military careers.
Most people come after a 10, a 17, or recently 20-something year history of eating disorder behavior.
Candy is treating 10 soldiers, a caseload that's now large enough that she started her first eating disorder therapy group and added a dietitian to the care team. She can't help everybody. She says about a third of her patients have to seek a higher level of care outside the military. But Candy says she's also had remarkable successes.
You know, I had a guy with a 17-year-old history turn it around just by outpatient treatment. So you can never guess who's going to respond.
Welcome to Adaptive Strength today.
It took years, but Marine veteran Teresa Larson is one of those service members who did respond to treatment. A decade after her discharge from the Marines, she owns a physical therapy and wellness company in San Diego, and once a week teaches an adaptive exercise class to fellow vets.
We are doing a warm-up that involves med ball.
Larson says helping veterans who've lost limbs or are adjusting to other limitations is an important part of her life and her recovery. She says she hasn't purged in years, and now blogs and gives speeches about her experience with bulimia in the military.
I don't blame the Marine Corps for anything. I think things could have been much better, but that's why we're starting this conversation and to get people help before they're broken.
The Department of Defense report noted the military already has a way to identify people who might need that help, the regular height and weight assessments that are required of troops. It's a matter of making sure that commanders understand eating disorders and encourage those who need treatment. I'm Patricia Murphy reporting.
Healthcare providers in the Northwest and across the country are getting more tools to fight drug overdose. The federal government has announced $2.8 million in grants to clinics in Washington. Paige Browning explains it's part of a broader plan to fight opioid abuse. Grants to clinics in Washington. Paige Browning.
Susan Johnson says there's a reason we're hearing about an epidemic.
In Alaska, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington, we lose an average of 153 people a month. This was in 2014 from drug overdoses. Far more than deaths caused by car crashes.
Johnson directs the Northwest Office of U.S. Health and Human Services. The grants from her department will be used to boost counseling for people addicted to heroin and other opioids like OxyContin. They're also aimed at tightening up how legal drugs are prescribed. The grants went to 8 clinics in Washington and more across the country. The opioid issue is getting special attention from U.S. Senator Patty Murray. She visited an addiction recovery center in Seattle Friday and spoke later with KUOW.
Addiction is a disease, and when we treat it as a disease and begin to have mental health and addiction be part of treatment, that is how we are going to begin to solve this problem.
Murray's working on legislation that would build on the work done through the grants.
You're listening to The Bridge for Thursday, March 17th. Our final report asks the question, how do you get 19-year-olds, or anyone else for that matter, to pay attention to warning signs? That's the question that state parks officials, lawmakers, and community members will face as they attempt to reduce the troubling number of deaths at Cape Kiwanda State Natural Area. Cape Kiwanda is part of the Three Capes Scenic Route, along with Cape Mears and Cape Lookout in Tillamook County. Kiwanda is the smallest of the three, but it's one of the best places to experience spectacular wave action. 7 people have died at the popular Cape Kiwanda Park since 2009, including 5 during the past 8 months. The average age of the victim was 19. Chris Hovel is a spokesman for the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. He calls the area a beautiful place, easy to reach, and there are lots of people who climb there. It's one of the places that draws people in, and even when they're confronted by signs and fences, they stop thinking about safety. Pat Cochran, director of Clatsop County Emergency Management, talked to us about what makes beach climbing in the North Coast so alluring and so dangerous.
So when I think of beach hazards, there's sort of a handful of them. Rip currents, sneaker waves, drift logs, rock outcroppings, and cliffs and trails are kind of the things that can cause us problems. The jetties and the rocks, you can get isolated at low tide. You go out there at low tide, high tide comes up, you can get stuck out there in the jetties and rocks. Rip currents, you're just out swimming, and you get caught in a rip current. You need to know what to do about that. Sneaker waves, they're sneaky, so they're unpredictable, so that's one of those things that you just kind of keep saying, don't turn your back on the ocean. Drift logs, they look fun, something you might want to climb on, but they're very dangerous, they're very heavy. The cliffs and trails, just getting to the beach, can sometimes be slippery. And the cold water, it's really cold water year-round. So those are kind of the handful of subject areas that tend to cause people the most grief at the beach, all of which, with some understanding, can prepare somebody from the valley, from Central Oregon, from anywhere, to have a fantastic time at the beach and be smart about it so you can come back and visit again another time.
In response to the most recent incidents, including 2 fatal accidents in February, state and county officials, along with Senator Arne Roblin, are taking part in a town hall meeting this morning in Pacific City to discuss how to prevent future incidents. There have been fencing and signs warning people to stay off the bluff since 1996. The fencing was extended to 1,200 feet long following a fatal accident in 2009. Hovel said, quote, more fencing and signs, along with devoting more staff time through park rangers, are things we know how to do, and that's where we'll start at the meeting. But we want to hear from the community and listen to other suggestions. close quote. Park officials are hoping for more input from the community. That town hall meeting is scheduled for 11:15 a.m. this morning at the Kiawanda Community Center in Pacific City. That's all we have time for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part of it or just want to hear it again, it is available as a podcast on our website. We enjoy hearing from you. Send your comments to News One, that's N-E-W-S and the numeral one at KMUN.org. And you can like us on Facebook. I'm Kate Brister. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time on The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.